This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A century ago, Prohibition was in full swing across the nation. Michigan actually got a head start on the rest of the United States, and the result was a soft opening for alcohol smugglers to practice their trade. Before long, an alcohol triangle between Windsor, Detroit, and Toledo took form, partly fueled by an increasingly popular mode of transportation, the automobile. Historian and Monroe resident Joe Boggs has written a new book called Prohibition's Proving Ground that explores this peculiar time in Michigan history. Joe Boggs, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So you point out that it's hard to understand what was going on in Michigan during Prohibition without thinking about the huge sea change that had just fundamentally changed life here, the advent of the automobile. How did you start to become aware of these parallel tracks within history?
Well, I think one of the perspectives that really gives me, a head start on this perspective is the fact that I actually teach at a public vocational high school. And therefore, I have to teach from a way that kind of integrates industry with history. So I teach here at Penner Career Center just south of Toledo. And it really got me thinking about the ways in which I could teach history through the lens of different industries, specifically in this case, the automobile.
You describe what was happening in Michigan at the time as the advent of the culture of automobility. How were cars changing people's lives in the 19-teens when the buzz about Prohibition started to build?
It really was kind of an unbelievable moment to live in this region. With John Willie setting up shop with the Overland Willys Company in Toledo, you had, you know, obviously the Ford Motor Company in Detroit, in the Detroit area. You had over in Canada, Gordon McGregor setting up Ford Motor Company of Canada there. So it really is kind of an automobile boom that allows people to find jobs. Like, for instance, in Windsor area, 40% of the employees were actually working in the automobile industry in the 1910s and 20s. So it's really an unbelievable moment in terms of thinking about the way that the car impacts the economy, but also the way in which people can enjoy life. There's tons of people in this region who essentially never wandered beyond their farm or their hometown, and now they have that ability to do that. And that also brings about the creation of good roads. A lot of people don't realize the roads during this time period, the 1910s, were basically muddy swamps, essentially. And there was the Dixie Highway that ran through Monroe County that was notoriously known as full of ruts. You get stuck almost all times of the year. So this really brought about better roads in our region.
So here we are at this time when Michigan's undergoing some big economic and social and cultural changes. And Detroit was going through exponential growth on its way to becoming the fourth most populous city in the country. What was important, geographically speaking, about this Toledo-Detroit-Windsor corridor for people who were trying to buy and sell alcohol?
What's really interesting about this region are the competing patchwork of legislation that's occurring with Prohibition. So, for instance, most people don't realize that Prohibition really starts in America in a patchwork fashion. There's various states that adopt it before the national prohibition of the 18th Amendment in 1920. So, for instance, in Michigan, Prohibition starts in 1918, but Ohio doesn't adopt it. So, therefore, you could go down to Toledo, Ohio, as a Michigan resident, purchase booze, and then try to smuggle it back. At first, they were trying to smuggle it back through the Inner Urban, which is an electric trolley system that operated between Toledo and Detroit. But eventually, you know, obviously with the automobile, it was much easier. You could determine when you could transport that booze. The cops would just be reactive. Whereas if you're on a trolley, you know, these agents could just board the trolley and bust you. But with the car, you can determine when you smuggle that booze.
I was absolutely fascinated by the idea of smuggling booze via trolley. I mean, were people actually trying to do it by the crate load, or were they just carrying as much as they could by hand?
It's humorous. At first, what happens is you have these just ordinary people who are going down to get a drink in Toledo and get drunk, but then they realize they can make money from it, so they're putting their coat pockets and so forth. But then the agents quickly find that out. So eventually they get more creative. Fake Bibles, fake babies. There were women who would get on the Inner Urban in places like Detroit or Monroe, go down very skinny, come back 8 months pregnant.
pregnant because they were carrying bottles of illegal alcohol under their coats.
Exactly. They had like straps of bladders around their stomach. And then eventually the Michigan State Police actually had to hire matron officers to start searching women.
So Michigan, from the way you put it in the book, Michigan sounds like it was something of a battleground state in terms of the larger picture of prohibition. Could you sort of cast who was on each side of the dry vote and the wet vote at the time?
Yes, absolutely. So most people realize that prohibition is very unsuccessful prior to the 1910s, even though there's these major organizations like the Anti-Saloon League, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the National Prohibition Party. Even though they're very powerful, no one's really buying into their argument. What happens in the 1910s is you have people like Henry Ford and a lot of the automobile tycoons of the region putting their force behind the prohibition law.
Why did the automakers have a stake in this?
Well, because, you know, when you're thinking about the reasons you would hope for a more productive workforce, obviously, if you have drunk workers who are constantly coming to work, causing inefficiencies, getting injured on the job, and you would also have tons of saloons and actually breweries and distilleries right outside the factory gates. Henry Ford is talking about this all the time. John Willys in Toledo actually talks about building the world's largest restaurant in his factory so that his employees don't go to the saloons during their work break.
Jeez. What did it mean for prohibition to have two states like Michigan and Ohio right next to each other with such different policies?
It creates a mess. Essentially, Toledo is known as the place where you go and do whatever you wish. And this is a place, from what I can gather, a lot of the Toledo businesses were supporting this smuggling activity because they knew it was very lucrative. Whereas in Michigan, you have, well, not necessarily in the Monroe County, Wayne County areas, but throughout the rest of the state, there was this movement to really crack down on smuggling and drinking. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize that Monroe County and Wayne County, they had voted actually against the state prohibition measure. So there was a hive of individuals in these counties, the Toledo, Detroit, Windsor corridor, that were in favor of drinking. So it makes this a very challenging thing because you have Lansing wanting to enforce the law, but then you have local residents in Monroe County and Wayne County not really wanting to comply with the law.
So at the same time as prohibition laws were getting underway, this was also an important time in America for organized crime. What did the advent of the automobile mean for illegal activity?
It meant everything, plain and simple. It meant everything in terms of, like I said earlier, being able to engage in criminal activity when you wanted, how you wanted, and where you wanted. But also, you know, later in the prohibition years, when organized crime becomes much more developed and much more brutal, these are tools of murder. The gangsters, the Purple Gang, the Yickaboli Gang down here in Toledo, they use these tools, these automobiles, to hijack, to murder fellow gang members who are kind of budging in on their territory. They use them to abduct people and then drive them off into essentially secluded areas of places like Monroe County, of places like Wayne County on the edges of the peripheries, and drop them off. It was very common to hear of these bodies just being found everywhere, and it was very clear that automobiles had dropped them off at a secluded road. One story I can think of, there was a Toledo car dealer. He had been involved with a gang down in the Toledo area, obviously. And he's abducted. His body is dropped off in Monroe County Road. The gangsters come back to the house where their boys were sleeping, and they order the boy to go across the street to get the newspaper to read about their father who had just been killed. Terrific.
Wow. Straight up Boardwalk Empire stuff.
Exactly.
What were the main arteries for the rum running trade when we get to the point that both Michigan and Ohio are under national prohibition laws?
The major artery was Canada. So Canada has the Ontario Temperance Act, which does ban the sale of alcohol for residents in the Windsor area. However, you can still manufacture it and you can still export it. So therefore, you have this country that's very thirsty and they're going to make a lot of money off that. So Windsor, for the most part, really does cooperate, not necessarily on a legal standpoint, but on an underworld standpoint. They are supporting the thirsty people of Michigan and Ohio. Yeah, so it comes directly across the river And once again, people underestimate the importance of cars here. Obviously, historians have documented the waterborne traffic coming from Windsor to the downriver and Detroit communities, but you need cars to transport that to customers.
It sounds like Michigan wasn't only important as a market in and of itself, but as a pathway for alcohol that was coming to other parts of the U.S. from Canada, right?
Exactly. And I think a lot of people think of Prohibition with Chicago, but Chicago's Prohibition culture doesn't exist without Detroit's Prohibition culture. And I would argue, in fact, that the Prohibition narrative begins and belongs in Detroit, not in Chicago.
Could you say more about that?
Yeah. So, for instance, we know that Al Capone and a lot of the Chicago area gangsters, they had to essentially establish ties with Detroit's gangsters, the Purple Gang, and those who controlled the rum trade. And there's this one story that you can't prove that Al Capone was in this town, but there's a town that I grew up in, Newport, Michigan, in 1920, at the very beginning of National Prohibition. There's an officer that's abducted by Chicago gangsters in the downtown area of Newport. And the gangsters essentially ask him, what's the back way up Detroit? We need to establish these ties. They throw him out the car. When they get back, if you document everything together and see what's happening in Chicago, Big Jim Colosimo, who was Al Capone's boss, was just assassinated a few days prior. He did not want Capone to get involved in the bootlegging business. So he gets whacked. And historians point to the fact that Al Capone quickly thereafter tried to establish ties with the Purple Gang because of the needed access to that quality booze that was coming out of Canada.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Joe Boggs. He has a new book called Prohibition's Proving Ground that explores early 19th century crime and enforcement in Michigan around the sale of alcohol. So, Joe, one of the things that was such a revelation about this book was the reminder that a lot of law enforcement didn't actually even have their own cars in those days. Can you guess maybe how many regular police or state police might have had access to vehicles at the time when Michigan's prohibition laws started going into effect?
Very few. They were on horse at first. And in fact, they had to set up roadblocks to stop the cars that were coming in. Sometimes you would have officers confiscate the rum runners' cars to transport them to the jails. So it was very few. And in fact, one of the earliest automobiles that's used by the state troopers at the Michigan-Ohio border is actually called Little Bertha. It was an armored vehicle from World War I, and it was meant to stop the rum runners who were driving through their blockades of horses and just, you know, regular stops. But eventually that Little Bertha armored vehicle was pulled off the road because you couldn't really see out the front of it, and it crashed into regular cars. So that wasn't very successful.
You tell this story in the book that was just hitting home as I was reading it on a very cold winter's day. It's a story from February of 1919 when the Michigan State Police were just in the early stages of trying to stop rum-running gangs before they had armored vehicles, before some of the escalation. Could you set the scene for us?
Yeah. So what happens that night in February is that the head of the state troopers learns that there's a convoy of cars coming up the Dixie Highway from Toledo. So they're ready for them around 3 a.m. And sure enough, these cars come through. And the first squad tries to stop them just south of Monroe on the Dunbar Road. But then they blow by their position, the rum runners. So they signal up the road. The second squad drops a telephone pole on the road. And one of the cars is going 60 miles per hour, hits that telephone pole. And as the newspapers describe it, turned turtle on the street. All the booze flows out. Two rum runners were kind of severely injured. And they actually made up a kind of, I think it seems to be a legend of a third person that was killed, that the police had basically took their body away. It becomes a very controversial touch point. The governor actually of Michigan at that time actually comes down on the state troopers never to do that again. And eventually the officers are sued a few years later for $2,000 for damages.
I mean, there's so much. I don't even know where to start with this whole story. Just the thought of them dropping a telephone pole across the road. The fact that the rum runners drove right into it. I mean, I guess that speaks to automotive braking technology of the time more than anything else. And the fact that the public was sort of outraged by this. is very interesting as well. I mean, you write that there was some questioning, you know, well, why didn't the state police just establish toll booths? I mean, would toll booths have stopped the rum runners, do you think?
They eventually did put a toll booth at the Dunbar Road, but what eventually happens is these rum runners just completely avoid that specific road. So you can't put toll booths everywhere. There's a whole network of roads that are being built just at this time as the automobile age advances. So it really is kind of a fruitless endeavor to put up toll booths at certain intersections when rum runners know that they exist and they just drive around them.
Joe, do you have a sense of how much alcohol was coming through the Toledo-Detroit-Windsor corridor by the time prohibition was at its height and the illegal trade was at its height?
Oh, it's hard to estimate. I know one historian, Philip Mason, has estimated that 75% of the alcohol that was being consumed in the United States during prohibition actually came through that a funnel of Windsor in the Detroit River area. I do know at the very beginning, it was estimated at the very beginning of national prohibition that 900,000 cases flowed over the Detroit River in the first 6 months.
Wow.
Now, one thing to think about as well here is the trade didn't stop when the water froze over. Model Ts and cars were flowing across the ice at all times of the winter. There was one interview that I read. She lived in the Monroe County region along the beaches there. And she said it was like growing up as a kid, it was like blackbirds descending upon the beach in the ice, the Model Ts. It was just unbelievable, she said.
Jeez. The other jaw dropper for me was just how much money was tied up in rum running. You write about the Billingsley gang getting involved in Michigan. Can you describe the scale of their investments once they decided they were going to try to get a toehold in the market?
Yes. So the Billingsley gang actually moved from the states of Kansas and Washington, which had previous state prohibition legislation, and they actually realized that the Toledo-Detroit area was going to be more lucrative. So they go ahead and purchase a fleet of vehicles, several warehouses in Toledo, and they establish business ties with Detroit groceryman to funnel alcohol up to them. And eventually they're caught in the fall of 1918, very early on in the state prohibition days. But they had made a couple $100,000 just in the 2 months. And we know this because there was an agent that infiltrated them. So if they were allowed to continue to work for, you know, the remainder of that year, they probably could have easily made close to $1 million because they were just starting.
Just the thought of them setting up not just a warehouse, but essentially buying these grocery chains, it just must have been an incredible amount of money for that time.
Exactly. Yeah, these individuals were highly organized. They knew what they were doing. And like we said, a lot of Americans don't realize there was a patchwork of legislation across the country. So there was organized crime in a lot of different states. But really, Toledo-Detroit area was the mecca of organized crime because of the automobility of the region. Cars were essential tools for these criminals, and very few other places had as many cars. And in fact, I would argue, actually, they didn't have as many cars as this area.
So there were a number of factors that undermined prohibition. The fact that the federal government didn't really fully fund enforcement, and corruption was such a problem among liquor control agents. And at the end of the day, as we are very much aware, America was not really ready to give up alcohol. So after prohibition was a thing of the past, were there any ways you were able to find in which the contraband highways established during this time with Detroit-made cars, were there any ways that these systems endured after prohibition was gone?
Not necessarily in regards to, you know, the ways that we think about in prohibition, but I think what we can say is prohibition allowed for these organized criminals to gather in this region. And, you know, obviously the automobile and, you know, the highway still exist. But the biggest effect that it has is that it draws people to this area. The mafia continues to exist after prohibition. They have control over larger organizations. But in regards to the way it worked back then, I think another thing to think about, too, is that policing does advance itself after prohibition because they're aware of how they operate. But still, I would argue that the automobile still allowed these criminals after prohibition to continue the things that they did, maybe just in a more reduced scale and maybe not as glamorous, because the newspapers really cover prohibition very well. You don't really see them covering the types of crimes after the Prohibition era like it did during it.
Joe Boggs' new book is Prohibition's Proving Ground: Cops, Cars, and Rum Runners in the Toledo-Detroit-Windsor Corridor. It's out on the University of Toledo Press. Joe, thank you so much for the book. It's a really, really interesting wintertime read, and thanks for talking to us about it, too.
Thank you so much, April.